WPFW Washington.
Greetings, greetings, greetings. Y bienvenidos a toda mi gente escuchando en Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. At Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, May 16th, 2025. We're also in the middle of WPFW's Spring Pledge Drive, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so, because our goal at this hour is $500. And it goes a long way to the long-term sustainability of not only the Latino Media Collective, but also WPFW and the Pacifica Network. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, considering the unprecedented media coverage that El Salvador has received in 2025 alone, whether it be the current administration's attack on migrant rights to the Sicat prison led by Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele's cozy relationship with the Trump administration, I would like to take this opportunity to say that this show, the Latino Media Collective, has been at the forefront of not only placing coverage of the various social justice issues of the country, but we have also done an entire show warning of the coming authoritarianism that we see in El Salvador today. The Latino Media Collective did our first show examining the creeping authoritarianism of Nayib Bukele as far back as 2018, 1 year before he became president. So let's begin by revisiting a conversation I had earlier this year with Jorge Cuellar, who is an assistant professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. This conversation is important because it not only mentions the illegality of Trump's arrangement with Bukele, but the illegality of Bukele's second presidential term, which is forbidden under the Salvadoran Constitution, but rarely mentioned in corporate media. This conversation also took place the week the Kilmer Abrego Garcia case became national headlines. Let's take a listen. Jorge, I wish we could talk under better circumstances, but welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Oscar. I'm glad to be back, man. It's a complex situation right now, but it always has been, you know. It always has been a complex situation. Now everybody's learning about it because of these, you know, spectacles that are being put on by the Bukele and the Trump administration.
And even though people are learning about this, they still have only hit the tip of the iceberg with regards to their understanding of the conditions, the political conditions in El Salvador, even before this arrangement with the Trump administration started. So let's be clear. El Salvador is getting nationwide coverage in the U.S. not seen since the Civil War in the 1980s. And it's all for the wrong reasons. We've had conversations in the past discussing the dark history of U.S.-supported dictatorships and authoritarian figures in El Salvador, from Hernandez Martinez to Roberto Dobison and everyone and everything in between. However, with current Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele, it feels to me, at least, like we are going down uncharted territory. So before we even discuss recent events like the Sicat prison that's made the headlines in the U.S. and Bukele's arrangement with the Trump administration to house migrants in the Sicat prison, can we address the very illegality of Bukele's current second and illegal, capital letters, illegal term as president right now? This needs to be broken down before we discuss anything else.
Yeah, man. So, you know, You and I both know this, but Bukele was unconstitutionally reelected last year. You know, he started his term in February 2024. And this is the first time a Salvadoran president who was bound by a five-year term was set up to run again. So in his first term, right, from starting in 2019, he begins to look for a loophole, basically, in the Salvadoran Constitution in order to figure out how to remain in power. He's overwhelmingly popular. That's undeniable, right? His first term, he gets spoon-fed a crisis, right, which is the pandemic. that he's perceived at this moment, right, to be one of the most competent leaders during the pandemic. Salvador is like him. There are many, you know, sort of deaths by COVID during this period, supposedly. He's managing the pandemic better than any foreign leader, right? You remember all these speeches that he would give in front of that mural of Oscar Romero, right, in the Constitutional Palace, the Presidential Palace, sorry. So he began to build this brand, right, throughout his first term, where he won by a landslide, right? There was opposition parties, the right wing Arena, the left wing FMLN, who at this point have very little steam left to them. And Bukele, right, emerging out of, you know, the rubble of these parties, one of which he gutted from the inside out, the FMLN, right, becomes president of El Salvador and has a very popular first term by launching this war against gangs, right? And also, you know, basically the war against COVID, right, that happened simultaneously. But it's throughout this first term where he's setting this sort of the groundwork, right, to stay in power for much longer. First of all, he cites his popularity. There's no one else in the country who's as popular as me. During the pandemic, he begins to, you know, make many promises to the Salvadoran people. First of all, getting rid of crime, you know, rebuilding various hospitals, inaugurates the pet hospital, Chibo Pets, presents the idea of Bitcoin as a solution for economic problems for regular people. So there's a lot of things that he's doing in order to like build up this image of being the infallible leader, right, for El Salvador. And so when you get to election season in 2021, Bukele is already planning a way to stay in power. There's no other president in the history of El Salvador except maybe Maximiliano Hernandez Martinez back in the 1930s, who does this, right? Who stays in power for sequential five-year terms, which are prohibited, right, by the Constitution, right? And so this is like Article 75 of the Constitution, right, that says that you can't stand for re-election. And so the loophole for Bukele is to step down a few months before the campaign season is set to start. And he puts the interim president, I believe it's a secretary or something like this. Like I can't remember her name. And so she becomes a de facto ruler of El Salvador for a little bit while he's standing for election. And so people can technically write off this technicality.
Quote unquote.
Quote unquote, right? Vote for him. And he wins by a landslide. But this was already something that was all but assured because he was incredibly popular, despite of the fact that he had bullied the Legislative Assembly during, I believe it was 2020, in order to give him money for a crime-fighting bill in order to arm the police and the armed forces, right, where he steps in with the military attaché into the Legislative Assembly, 9th of February, never going to forget that date, right, where he basically, you know, does a self-coup or an auto-coup, as people called it in that moment, in order to bully legislators to pass this bill, right, to let these funds go in order to, for him to continue this program in the fight against the gangs, right? And so even despite these kinds of democratic hits, right, that he does against different aspects of the state, the Legislative Assembly, the dismissal of the Supreme Court judges, Constitutional Court judges, sorry, as well as the forced retirement of many judges all across the country after age of 50 or 60, I can't remember what it was. But the point being is that there's a kind of remaking of the Salvadoran state in the image of Bukele throughout that first term, right, where he's laying the groundwork for a legislative that is now stacked with loyalists, right? People that are faithful and loyal to him and to his party, who are now going to sort of look the other way and, you know, just rubber stamp anything that he proposes. And this is the kind of sort of political culture that Bukele, you know, sets into motion during those first 5 years or first really 4 years of his presidency. And so when you get to the point of re-election, right, which is, again, prohibited by the Constitution, there's a whole new set of judges, right, and a whole new set of legislators that are reinterpreting things in order to enable him to do what it is he wants to do. But they've already been inculcated over the past few years to just approve, right, and to rubber stamp everything that he presents to them, whether it be, right, the approving of these funds for the security apparatus, whether it's the renewal of the state of exception, right?
Yes.
That it now has been renewed over 30 times, right? It has to be renewed every 30 days. And so it's this kind of like just incredible smoothing of all the different institutions of government in order to allow the executive to do whatever whatever it is it wants. And so that's what's set up in those first 4 years. So by the time you go up for reelection, there's a reinterpretation of the Constitution that enables his standing for reelection as if he was a new candidate, but he's an incumbent, right? Which already we know is going to lead to certain levels of support. And this is a, an election that takes place under a state of exception, right? This is already just kind of like a sort of sham election in many ways. There's no opposition as well.
Thank you for breaking down the political situation in El Salvador right now, because this is something that's missing in U.S. corporate media when discussing El Salvador right now. Even people who are strongly opposed to what the Trump administration is doing with this arrangement with Bukele is not bringing what you just mentioned into context or even into the conversation. You know, oftentimes right-wing governments in Latin America will follow whatever model, whatever Trump-like model there is in the United States. But I think I could argue, or we could argue, that it's actually the Trump administration trying to copy the Bukele model as far as governance is concerned, because as we have this conversation right now, Trump is floating the idea of running for a third term, which is insane, not to mention unconstitutional. So now that we have that in context, let's go straight to the issue by addressing the illegality of Bukele's administration's arrangement with the Trump administration to send migrants to El Salvador. Perhaps the best example of the scheme is the recent story last week of Gilmar Abrego Garcia, a Salvadoran migrant living in Maryland who was wrongfully deported despite having protected status. Since then, the Department of Justice has admitted that his deportation was an administrative error. Here is White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt responding to a reporter when asked about this case. Let's take a listen.
Jeff, a few minutes ago, you said you'd seen evidence that this man was a convicted gang member. In what court was he convicted and for what?
This individual was an MS-13 ringleader. This individual was also engaged in human trafficking. And I'm glad you brought up this point again, because I would like to point out that if you just saw the headline from the insane failing Atlantic magazine this morning, you would think this individual was father of the year, living in Maryland, living a peaceful life, when that couldn't be further from the truth. They didn't even mention in the title of that article or even in the first paragraph that this individual is an illegal criminal who broke our nation's immigration laws. He is a leader in the brutal MS-13 gang, and he is involved in human trafficking. And now MS-13 is a designated foreign terrorist organization. Foreign terrorists have no legal protections in the United States of America. And this administration is going to continue to deport foreign terrorists and illegal criminals from our nation's interior.
But a judge ordered that he should remain in this country. So are you saying that it is okay to ignore a judge's ruling if you don't like it?
Who does that judge work for?
An
immigration judge who works for the Department of Justice at the direction of the Attorney General of the United States, whose name is Pam Bondi, who has committed to eradicating MS-13 from our nation's interior. And let me tell you why we've made this commitment. MS-13, may I remind each and every one of you, is a brutal and vicious gang. They raped and strangled a 20-year-old autistic woman to death in Maryland. They hacked 4 people to death with machetes in a park on Long Island. They have kidnapped, sexually tortured, and shot a teenage girl in Texas after she insulted them, allegedly. Killed and mutilated a 17-year-old girl in Virginia, stabbing him 16 times and cutting off his hands. They beheaded and cut out the heart of a man in Washington, D.C. They raped and murdered a 13-year-old girl in California. They sex trafficked a slew of young girls, including one who was just 12 years old. Raped an 11-year-old girl in Brooklyn while her brother was in the room. Sex trafficked a 13-year-old in Maryland and Virginia, miles away from this White House, even beating her 26 times on her backside with a baseball bat. Pressured homeless New Yorkers to undergo unnecessary surgeries such as spinal fusion in order to bolster their fraudulent lawsuits. These are vicious criminals. This is a vicious gang. And I wish that the media would spend just a second of the same time you have spent trying to litigate each and every individual of this gang who has been deported from our country as the innocent Americans whose lives have been lost at the hands of these brutal criminals. We maintain our position, and very strongly so.
That was disgusting. And it's certainly a look into the mind of madness with this current administration. So with that said, now here's a CBS News report, which includes an interview with Abrego Garcia's wife last week. Let's take a listen.
I waited and waited. He never made that call.
Jennifer says when her husband, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, was detained and mistakenly deported by immigration authorities in March, he told her he could be sent to Secot, the notorious Salvadorian prison.
I was scared. I was very scared.
Why?
Because I've seen news of that prison, and I knew they take criminals there, and my husband's not a criminal.
Abrego Garcia was granted legal status protecting him from deportation back to El Salvador in 2019 because of safety concerns in his home country. Jennifer says he continued to check in with immigration officials until he was stopped by ICE on March 12 in Maryland. Just days later, Jennifer saw this photo of Abrego Garcia inside Secot.
When I saw it, I immediately broke down because I knew it was him.
What was your biggest fear when you identified him?
I was scared for his life.
In court documents filed Monday, the government said although ICE was aware of his protection from removal, Abrego Garcia was removed to El Salvador because of an administrative error. Now that he's out of the country, officials say they have no jurisdiction to bring him back.
The error that you are referring to was a clerical error. It was an administrative error.
The Trump administration acknowledged the mistake, but defended Abrego Garcia's deportation.
He is a leader in the brutal MS-13 gang, and he is involved in human trafficking.
The White House did not detail any evidence that proves those allegations. Jennifer says her husband is not a gang member, but instead just a proud father of their 5-year-old son with disabilities.
He's not a criminal. My husband is an amazing person, an amazing father.
So that was the wife of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. So again, Jorge, as that case as an example, give us your thoughts here with regards to Bukele's arrangement here with the Trump administration. The case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, you know, may not be the first case, but it certainly won't be the last one so long as this scheme continues.
Yeah, man. I mean, there's so much going on in those clips, you know, with Caroline Leavitt, man, the way that she, you know, sort of plays upon this very stereotyped notion of Salvadoran people, on migrants, on, you know, what she believes or is the culture of hardworking Central Americans in the United States. Like, it's terrible, man. It draws upon the most ridiculous, damaging, hurtful, racist stereotypes of Central American people possible, you know, and builds on, you know, Trumpian rhetoric of, like, for example, you know, when he says that MS-13 are animals and they're these violent criminals and they're bad hombres and they're rapists, right? It really just builds on that, right? Almost as if that's the new, you know, political kind of common sense about what Central America is to this administration. And so she just builds on that. She can't recognize, right, the humanity of this working class person, right? She can't recognize the fact that this is a person who, through, as we've now found out, right, administrative error, was deported to El Salvador, when this person had done absolutely nothing wrong and had temporary protected status and all of this, no?
Just to be clear with the timeline, she admitted that this was an administrative error, but then still went on that rant that we just heard. So please continue.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's no way that, first of all, much like Trump, there's no sense that the administration can admit anything, it has done anything wrong, right? Everyone's against him. Everyone wants to stop what it is that they're doing, right? She says, we can't focus on these individual cases. We got to think about MS-13, you know, the now terrorist organization, right? Like, this is the kind of thing that, you know, she's really hired to do, right? Sort of spin all these kinds of issues in that direction and support the Trump agenda by any means necessary. And it's so clear here, you can't unlink that from this really racist and xenophobic perspective on what migrant people are in general, right? They're just inherently criminal. You know, the clip of the wife speaking about her husband, right? And And their family, like, just goes to show you that these are humble people, you know, making ends meet, working class people, right, who have absolutely no connection to these criminal structures that they're going on about. The fact that the U.S. government, right, with all of its resources and intelligence about transnational criminal organizations, et cetera, is able to make this kind of quote-unquote administrative error is absolutely baffling to me, right? Because it's absurd, right? This is a person, right, who has no criminal record. Is a Salvadoran national, but has lived in Maryland for quite a long time, right? Has a couple of children who I believe are special needs as well, right? There's no indication that this person was involved in any kind of illegal or criminal activity. In fact, right, fled in Salvador precisely because he was attempted to be forcefully recruited into gangs, you know? And so, like, it's just absurd, right? That, like, that sort of criminalizing logic that the Trump administration is operating under is almost the same one that the Bukele administration is operating under too, where depending on where you're from, right, and what your background is, what your class is, who your family is, right, you're guilty by association. And I think that's the kind of logic that the administration is operating under, and that the Bukele administration is operating under precisely why, and this is precisely why, right, they've been able to arbitrarily detain thousands upon thousands of people in Salvador, in the, you know, in the Secot, in the maximum security prison, and in others, precisely for being from the wrong community, right? Or for being related to somebody who might actually be involved, but you have absolutely no control over that person. You're not that person, right? But it's this kind of guilt by association that they're operating under, and they keep mobilizing in the discourse, right? That everybody from El Salvador that we've deported is obviously MS-13. Right, or is obviously 18th Street, or is obviously, for the Venezuelans, right, Tren de Aragua. It's this one-size-fits-all criminalizing logic that is absolutely false and ridiculous and dehumanizes, you know, Salvadorians and Central American working-class people, right, and Latin American working-class people in general, right, as being associated with the criminal elements that are found in their nations or in their communities, you know? And that's an absurd sort of conflation that they're operating under. They don't want to, you know, recognize the fact, right, that people like Kilmer, right, are law-abiding, that are, you know, contribute to their communities, that are, you know, have a strong network of support and, you know, strong relationships with their families, right, that they're building their own families in places like Maryland. Like, they simply do not want to recognize that, because to recognize that, I think, from the perspective of the Trump administration, is a sort of kind of slippery slope, right? Where then they're going to have to recognize the legitimate claims of belonging and of permanence of Central American people in the United States.
So we just heard a clip from, I guess I had earlier this year, Jorge Cuellar, who's an assistant professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. And he was discussing this criminal arrangement between Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele with the Trump administration. And I recorded this conversation with him just as the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia gained national headlines. And that sort of lends itself to the importance of supporting independent media outlets like WPFW. And so right now I am joined by Katia Stitt, who's the program director for WPFW. And Katia, before you say anything, I just want to give a shout out to everyone who has fought the good fight and did a tremendous amount of work on Thursday with regards to the whole Radio Free Palestine project that was running on WPFW. Yesterday, we have done our part by doing several shows with regards to Palestine and Latin American solidarity with Palestine as well. And so again, that lends itself to the importance of independent media outlets like WPFW. So again, we are in the middle of WPFW's Spring Place Drive. So right now is the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective at this hour. I would tell everyone to go to WPFWFN.org to make a donation. Our goal at this hour is $500. Every little bit counts in small amounts. And I just have to say, Katia, that one of the things that really lends itself to the importance of independent media outlets like the Latino Media Collective is that right now we've seen a lot of unprecedented headlines as it relates to El Salvador and Salvadoran people here in the U.S. And it's a type of media coverage that we have not seen since the 1980s. And it's all for the wrong reasons, I would have to say. But in outlets like WPFW, with the platform that we have here, we have spoken about President Nayib Bukele as far back as 2018, a whole year before he actually became president and set all these chains of events in motion. And so I bring this up to you, Katia, because the Salvadoran community here in Washington is part of the D.C. community. And so I would argue to say that as a son of Salvadoran immigrants, Salvadoran history in Washington is Washington history as well. And it's only possible by supporting outlets like WPFW.
Absolutely, Oscar. As we're still, of course, recovering from a long day of programming at Radio Free Palestine here on WPFW. And I'm happy to join you today. I would say that, you know, thanks to the Latino Media Collective, folks like Norberto, who was here very early on, as you know, with WPFW, I think helped to bring you in and others in and ensuring that we kept, and of course you took the mantle up and have run with it, but it's really important for WPFW because of our mission to keep the plight, if you will, of our immigrant family in front of us. And absolutely, when you say Salvadorian history is DC history, there is no separation. Of course, you remember the Mount Pleasant riots. I forget the years, but, you know, WPFW has been there.
1901.
Yes, exactly. You know, and we have been there. We have reported on it. We continue to report on what's happening, whether it's in Latin and South America or right here in D.C. throughout the diaspora. Of course, I live in Tacoma Park, and Langley Park has a huge Latinx community. And so it's important for you to do this work, and it's important for the Latino Media Collective to have a platform like WPFW to do the work on. So we want to ask you right now to please go to the phones and pledge your support. I know often I've tuned into the Latino Media Collective, and I know I'm not alone. Many of the listeners have learned something. Not only have we learned, but we've also then been inspired, so inspired by a conversation, to learn more, to be curious. You know, that is the beauty of a WPFW listener. They are curious. They are intellectual folk, a lot of them. Or they're folks that just want to understand what's really happening. You know, they from other media outlets, they might hear or see the headline, they might hear the, you know, the sound bite. But what you do on the Latino Media Collective is take a deep dive. And that is what we're all about here at WPFW. And then we can educate ourselves more. You know, we can get the book, we can watch the documentary, we can listen to the podcast. But WPFW gets that ball rolling, and Latino Media Collective gets that ball rolling. So right now, as Oscar said, we have a $500 goal for this hour. The number to call, 800-222-9739. Or you can go online to WPFWFM.org. And by the way, there is a PayPal option when you do that. After you hit the Donate Now button, many of you are hooked up with PayPal. It's just quick and easy. You could also text to donate, WPFWFM to 801-801. And finally, Cash App is always there. And I know many folks have that set up as well. It's quick and simple, easy. And that is $WPFWFM. So however you connect with us, it's really important, especially now, that you understand the critical nature of having a free press. Understand the critical nature of having a program that Oscar Fernandez, as a volunteer, produces the excellent work that he does, not only on the air, but of course, bringing the excellent work he does in that community off the air onto our air. And so we ask you now to support it at whatever level you can. You might have $5 to give. We know, Oscar, there are many people who are hurting right now based on what has been happening, right? Many, many people are really hurting. But we also know there are some people in this area that have done very well. And this is the time that they can do something incredible for not only themselves, but more importantly, their community and for a free press. So, you know, there are many ways to resist. I count WPFW among them, and certainly supporting the Latino Media Collective and the work that you all do is also among them. 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org. $500 is our goal.
I'm glad that you stress the importance of a free press right now during this place drive, because one of the things that's happening right now this week as we are having this conversation, going back to the issue of El Salvador and the Salvadoran community here in Washington, Nayib Bukele is clamping down and calling out for the arrest of journalists who have written about his shady dealings with gang members in El Salvador. One of the journalists that he's been targeting is Nelson Rauda from El Faro, and he's been on our show at least three times on the show here. He's a good friend of mine. We've actually spoken more about sports with regards to politics in El Salvador as an example of how even sports is not immune to the institutional corruption that is in El Salvador, which is largely a legacy of the history of U.S. intervention and imperialism in places like El Salvador. And so again, Washington history is also Salvadoran history, and it ties itself in one form or another back and forth. And I just want to say right now, Katia, since your time is short, that I want to pull back the curtain for a second here, because a few months ago, I actually did a show on the late Shafiq Hando, who was a Salvadoran politician of Palestinian descent, which is one of several shows that we've done connecting Latino solidarity with the people of Palestine. And in my conversation with Amy Fayez, who's a Salvadoran student currently in Lebanon right now, she mentioned an artist by the name of Atel Adnan. And in one of our correspondence behind the scenes, you mentioned the importance of this artist as well. And it's just sort of one of those things where, you know, it didn't occur to me. She mentioned it in passing, Amy Fayez, during our conversation. But then you texted me and told me, oh, you know, this is actually a bigger person than I realized. So I just want to throw that out there because, again, there's a lot of cultural back and forth that people do not realize or are not, shall we say, as educated as they should. And that's why outlets like WPFW are so important to educating the public when journalism is done correctly. Because what is journalism when done correctly but the pursuit of knowledge? So again, as Katia said, we are in the middle of WPFW's place drive, and everything that we've discussed thus far here lends itself to the importance of that. So again, the number to call is 1-800-222-9739. You can also make a donation, as Katia mentioned, to WPFWFM.org. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, go to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. So sorry if I put you on the spot there, Katia, but I just had to share that story because it gives you an idea of some of the correspondence we get every once in a while behind the scenes by the programmers.
Well, you know, I listen to the Latino Media Collective all the time, first of all. So I have followed your reporting on Bukele. I know this is not new for you. And yes, when I heard her name, Atel Adnan, I was so excited because I just fell in love with her work. And it's funny, she was not the main artist, Kandinsky. It was a Kandinsky exhibit at the Guggenheim. But she was, I don't know, somehow they tied her and Kandinsky together. And for me, she's so much more powerful than he is. I'm sorry. I was just like, I mean, he's great. Don't get me wrong, right? But also, she was a multimedia artist. She produced books. She produced short video. She did painting. She did drawing. She was a visionary artist, you know, and we know so little about her. And, you know, we can even tie that to, in some ways, imperialism and colonialism. You know what I mean? Because if she were in a different body and a different place, right, in the West, I suspect she would be much, and eventually she did. She moved to California. But she wasn't. She's a Lebanese artist. And, you know, we say Lebanese, but she could very well be of Palestinian descent, because we know that many people went to Lebanon when they were removed from Palestine during the families during the Nakba. And they grew up in Lebanon, even though they're of Palestinian descent. And so, you know, even with the knowledge of this brilliant artist, this is what WPFW lends you. And you're absolutely right. Journalism at its best. We're not here to tell you how to think, but we're here to give you things to think about and to research. Exactly. I mean, that is the job, you know? And if you take Bukele on face value based on what you hear on some other outlets, you will think he's just some kind of cooperative president. That's not at all the case. And here at WPFW, Pacifica Radio, the Latino Media Collective, almost single-handedly, even throughout the Pacifica Network, I have to say, has been bringing this gentleman to light over and over again, so we get a full picture of who he is. One of the reasons, because of the Latino Media Collective, we know that he is so eager to take these folks who are being deported, because he is concerned that some of them may be MS-13 members that know a little too much about his dealings there. You know, and one way to ensure that they don't show up in a U.S. court and talk is to lock them in CECOT. So, again, this is the knowledge I've gained from listening to Latino Media Collective and following all the good work that Oscar does. And we're asking you to do the same now. Please resist in the way that you can. This is one of the easiest ways you'll ever find. And you'll be doing so very much to ensure an independent and free network like Pacifica Radio, like WPFW, and a platform for an excellent program like Latino Media Collective. $500 to go, 800-222-9739. I'll slow down a little bit when I give the website, WPFWFM.org. However you get to us, you know, get to us. As Donnie Hathaway says, we need you now. This is the time. Do not procrastinate. And Oscar, if I can add one more thing, we're also in a blessed place. You know, we're in a privileged place where we don't have corporate underwriting or governmental funding that they can pull. We just have the people, you know, and the people always win. The people united can never be defeated. And that is with the media as well. So we are here for it. And Latino Media Collective is obviously reporting on all of it. So please give now, give generously, give what you can. $5, $5,000, all of it counts. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org.
Absolutely. And Katia, thank you for your time. I know that Thursday was extremely busy, but we have to fight the good fight in order to bring out this information and the pursuit of knowledge as well when it comes to Palestine and any other parts in Latin America and everything in between in
That's
this
right.
small planet that we live on. And so I'm going to call an audible right here and go straight to the next clip, because as the assault on immigrant rights continues under the current Trump administration, it should always be noted that what we are seeing today, however heinous they are and videos that go viral, American history tells us that it is neither new nor original. So earlier this year, we had an episode on the history of Mexican repatriations during the Depression era, the Great Depression era, which tells us a lot about what we see today. And so here's a clip from Emiliano Aguilar, a political labor historian and an assistant professor in the history department at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana, along with freelance writer Nikki Duda, discussing how Mexican repatriation affected states like Indiana. So let's take a listen. So we're going to go back and forth from the past to the present to explain why repatriation from the 1930s remains relevant today. So let me begin with Professor Aguilar by asking two questions. One, could you explain the Mexican repatriation of the 1930s as a means not to confuse it with the aforementioned Bracero program, which is a totally different issue, but equally important as well? And two, how does the state of Indiana serve as the best backdrop to explain the institutional racism behind the repatriations? Again, this was nationwide, but Indiana in particular serves as a special backdrop, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So repatriation movement, thinking quite literally, repatriation or the act of repatriating to send someone back to their own country is really a contested word for this decade of betrayal, as two historians, Francisco Valderrama, Raymond Rodriguez, call this period that coincides with the Great Depression. So we think of repatriation movement as this quote unquote voluntary return of Mexicans from 1929 to 1939. And while the numbers are really contested, right, anywhere ranging from 300,000 to 2 million, depending on the source, the key takeaway from this is that something that's described as a voluntary movement of folks from their new homes or from their areas, their environments, their residencies in the United States back to Mexico is quite conflated. Many of these were themselves actually American citizens. And thinking about Indiana in particular, it lets us see how one particular generation, sort of this first generation born of immigrant parents, are sent home, are threatened to be sent home, threatened to be sent to Mexico, I should say. Their home is the United States, during a period where non-Mexicans, non-Latinos are viewing the Mexican as an economic threat. They're taking their jobs. This is a moment of economic precarity that many folks are trying to solve, right? How do we fix the Great Depression? And in the Indiana context, we see a group, the American Legion, and their commander, Paul Kelly, really take it upon themselves to do so. They solicit funds from places like Inland Steel, the very company that recruited Mexicans as strikebreakers in 1919 during the Great Steel Strike, now provide money to send Mexicans to Mexico and Mexican Americans to Mexico. So Indiana becomes quite a neat way to complicate this idea of this being voluntary, while also complicating the idea that, you know, this is done federal government down, and really highlighting the grassroots efforts of quite literally like very xenophobic actions within a community.
We could easily have this conversation with regards to border states like Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California, but in the case of the state of Indiana, we may be focusing mostly on the north side of Indiana, East Chicago, places like Gary, that part of the region there in the state of Indiana. But as we said before, this was nationwide. And you mentioned a very important issue right there, which is strike breaking, which we will hit upon further during the course of this conversation. But Nikki, as I mentioned, you recently wrote an article for In These Times about your family connection to the repatriation of the 1930s. I wonder if you give us a few details of your family history that you believe run parallel to recent anti-immigrant sentiment here in the U.S. It's a sweeping question, I know, but again, we are living in a time not only of anti-immigrant sentiment, but also sort of a moment of anti-history as well, that there's not enough emphasis that what's happening, as I said before, is neither new nor original.
Sure. So a few summers ago, my grandmother passed away. She was born and raised, lived her entire life in East Chicago. And my mom was also born there and grew up there. And so after she passed, my mom and I went to the East Chicago Public Library because they have a room there that Emiliano knows, I'm sure, with a great local historian, Susana Bursic, and a lot of cool primary documents and old microfilms and stuff like that. And we were thinking we would go see if we could find a picture of my grandma's old apartment building in the harbor, which is the neighborhood that we're talking about in East Chicago. And we couldn't find that, but Susanna handed us a book called Harbor Lights, Mexican-American Harbor Lights. And she said, look up your family's last name in the back. Maybe there's something there, because my mom's grandfather worked in the mills. Her dad worked in the mills. Yeah, so she looked up their last name. She looked up Lopez, and there was a story written by one of my grandma's sisters, an essay, talking about this moment where the family almost left. So my grandma would have been about 2 years old. And I had never heard this story. And it was shocking to me because I knew about this. I knew about the repatriation movement, and we had never been told about it. So it kind of, one of my older aunts knew, I think, which I mentioned in the article, but it kind of highlighted this shame that was associated with that time of like being the other, having your neighbors turn against you, having people pressuring you to leave, having people not want to live in the neighborhood where they work, which we'll talk about later with the Walker Report, because you're there, because you're making the neighborhood bad, you're making it dirty, you're bringing syphilis into the community, you're bringing crime and all these other things, which obviously are not true and have some nativist and xenophobic elements. Of course, our family on that side has always been very proud of their heritage, and at the same time has this desire to appear very American, this desire to, yeah, not to be identified with anything immigrant, which maybe someone who hears that will get upset that I said that, but that's neither here nor there. And so it kind of illuminated the why there. And it kind of also illuminated what people are going through right now and how that's going to affect future generations growing up, how it's going to affect their relationship with their identity, how it will shape their relationship to the community, wanting to learn Spanish or not, or your name is Marcelino and you go by Mark or something like that. So yeah, and also it was in East Chicago, it was maybe up to, correct me if I'm wrong, Emiliano, but maybe like 2,000 to 2,500 families who were affected, or not families, people, and many more in Chicago. And when I shared this article on social media, I had someone who I've known since first grade, who's also Mexican-American, wrote me and said, hey, that happened to my family and they did go back. And then my grandparents had to immigrate again later, that he has a great aunt who is a U.S. citizen who went back and lived the rest of her life in Mexico. Like, it totally shifted the course of his family's history and broke their ties with the United States, even though they had this daughter who was born an American. And in the harbor, there were, you know, baseball teams. I know my grandpa played on a baseball team in the harbor, and they were like engaged in all these very traditionally American activities, and that, yeah, that their neighbors didn't see it that way and saw them as an other, which in a lot of ways had to do with this strike as well as good old fashioned racism.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up this issue of the desire to be American or be more American, as you said, because I sort of had that feeling that that was something underlying the institutional racism that is not only mentioned in your article for In These Times, but also in a few articles that Professor Aguilar wrote in Belt Magazine, that this was mentioned in passing, which is not only discovering this family information, but the difficulties of finding this information as well. So I guess my question is here is that, did this institutional racism that both of you have spoken about, and Professor Aguilar, you can answer this as well, also extended to even record keeping with regards to people not trying to associate themselves with being Mexican or hiding their last names or hiding the fact that they speak another language? Because I felt like doing my research with regards to this issue before today's interview, this was something that was also underlying the fact that this is not as covered as often as it should. And to what I said earlier, which is this moment of anti-history that we're living in, Professor Aguilar.
Absolutely. Institutional racism and this intersection or this impact on record keeping, I mean, becomes a very key bit on why early Latino history in particular becomes so difficult to document, right? The fact that with the exception of this particular moment of repatriation, Latinos aren't even a census category well until 70s and 80s, right? Where we start to see the rise of Hispanic. And so much of it becomes even like what we know of 1930 is tied inherently to wanting to exclude the Mexican. And in this exclusion, we sort of see a want, a desire to hide identities wherever possible, right? In East Chicago, one of the really great examples of this is Greg Estelle, who was a lawyer, but by that name alone, you would never have guessed he's a Latino, right? That he purposely changes his name. He's white passing. He gets to live in the north side of East Chicago away from the early colony that, like Nikki mentioned, one of the densest concentrations of Mexicans in the United States. Thousands of folks within this one square mile, estimated of about 5,000. And Estelle and his family get to live outside of that because of his white passing, because of this change of the name. And it affords him, as well as his like middle class professional background as a lawyer, a degree of protection during this moment. He and his family have this degree of protection because of that. And then in terms of like just keeping the records, the repatriation movement in Chicago crafts sort of these lists that we'll talk about here in a bit, these lists that let the American Legion in particular keep track of who's Mexican, how many Mexicans are living, where are they in a particular residence, what they do for work, are they on welfare or not, how many children do they have, what are those children's names. It becomes a really, I described it to Nikki, haunting document, a primary source to have been left behind, this record that both gives us an opportunity to see how vibrant this community was, but also the precarity of their situation, that knowing that we only know this information because this dedicated cohort of American Legion members wanted to subsequently repatriate or really just deport these families of mixed status too.
So going back to Nikki, considering what Professor Aguilar just mentioned, can you tell us, once you discovered this information about your family history, how difficult was it afterwards to try to make these connections afterwards of this moment in history?
Yeah. So one of my great aunts, my grandma's youngest sister, had written an essay that was part of this collection created by women from the neighborhood. And in it, she mentions that they were going to be sent, quote unquote, back to Mexico because my great grandparents immigrated and all of their kids were born in the United States, in Kansas and in Indiana. And so from her essay, it was pretty clear what was going on. And we were able to talk to Susanna about it over at the library. And it kind of highlights a lot of what, like you guys are saying, what mixed status families are worried about going through today, because you have the Holman or whatever his name is, the border czar, saying, oh, if it comes to it, instead of separating families, we'll just deport them all together. And we kind of like to act like that's this absurd thing and that couldn't be done and you can't deport U.S. citizens. But that's happened in the past, even if it's been in a way of like the community pushing people out or if it's been in an official capacity, that's something that's happened. And so, yeah, we were able to find out more about that, but it wasn't like nobody in the family knew anything else. So it became a kind of trying to see if we could find some kind of paper trail, trying to learn more about when my great-grandparents came to East Chicago and all of that. Because like I said, my grandma had already passed. We couldn't ask her.
I really appreciate you sharing this family history as well, because the audience needs to understand that when it comes to the great immigration debate in this country, oftentimes it refers to the Latino community in the East Coast, in the West Coast, on border states, but not much is said often as it should with regards to Latinos in the Midwest, which is why we're also having this conversation today. Now, in addition to racism and xenophobia, other underlying issues fueling anti-immigrant sentiment, which Nikki kind of alluded to already, includes economic uncertainty, jobs, lack of affordable housing, even migrant labor exploitation. So for example, Professor Aguilar wrote an article in Belt Magazine in 2021 entitled East Chicago's Failed Utopian Visions, which went into detail on something called the Walker Report. So without making this sound like a loaded question, you know, what was the Walker Report? Because I'll tell you this right now, to pull back the curtain, before we started recording, I thought to myself, this sounds very Project 2025, but please describe it to us.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Walker Report, named for Chicago consulting engineer James Walker, is a study that East Chicago had done in the 1920s as they're trying to really develop who they want to be as a city. This is a moment of boosterism, of industrialization. Northwest Indiana, considered the last frontier of Indiana, is starting to develop and industrialize. It's attracting Chicago businessmen, investors, and industries over the state line to develop these sprawling industrial metropolis, industrial parks. And East Chicago sees itself as the opportunity to become this city on the lake, 100,000 people. And they're quickly thrown off. Well, why is our population stagnating? Why aren't we growing and becoming this industrial utopia on Lakefront Michigan? So upon hiring James Walker, Walker and his associates do a survey of 10,000 industrial workers, extensive research project by any means, right, in any era. And they're questioning folks after their shifts, why don't you live in East Chicago? Why will you work in this city but not live here? And from those 10,000, a quarter of the respondents cite that they refuse to live in East Chicago because of its foreigner, Black, and Mexican presence. That they are directly citing these three elements in order of responses. It's, you know, they're citing Black East Chicagoans being the main reason, Mexicans, and then foreigners. These are the reasons why they choose to live elsewhere in what were then more ethnically European or native-born, quote-unquote, American cities in places like Hammond and parts of Gary, particularly east side of Gary, Indiana, neighboring cities, as well as Whiting, which is overwhelmingly, at this time, ethnic Eastern European. So they're choosing to live elsewhere because of East Chicago's racialized population. And Walker tells the city directly that to solve this, there's two solutions. You could just build new parts of the city that exclude directly these elements, or you could slowly start to add in restrictive covenants, ban these communities from buying homes outside of neighborhoods and contain them just where they are, which is sort of one of the reasons why we see such a densely concentrated Mexican community in the harbor, like Nikki wrote about. Again, 5,000 in a square mile, like that is a ridiculous, when you think about its size. There's stories that both James Walker and his associates, but also University of California labor economist Paul S. Taylor, who did a study about Mexican labor in the early 20th century, a multi-volume study, notes that there's occasions of 16 plus people living in the same apartment because of the swing shift that, you know, four of us will sleep here for these 6 hours while you 12 are gone, and then just continually rotate through a four-person cycle, which is mind-boggling to think of how densely concentrated this community was.
This has been the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. And before we wrap things up, we want to remind everyone that we are in the middle of WPFW's Spring Place Drive. So once again, make a donation at this hour to WPFWFM.org. You can also make a call to 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. We want to thank everyone who supported us this month during the course of this Place Drive. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. It's not too late to make a donation, so please make a donation online or over the phone or on a Cash App whenever you can, however you can. And thank you very much, everyone, for listening.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, May 16. Here are some headlines. Israeli strikes on Gaza have killed more than 250 people since yesterday, local health authorities said today. The strikes over the past 2 days have marked one of the deadliest phases of bombardment since a truce collapsed in March, with a new ground offensive expected soon. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed earlier in the week to push ahead with a promised escalation of force in the Gaza Strip to pursue his aim of destroying Hamas. This comes as Israel continues to block all food, fuel, medicines, and more from reaching Gaza. No humanitarian aid has entered Gaza since mid-March. Food supplies have run out, community kitchens are shutting down, and hospitals are collapsing due to a lack of medicine and basic resources. According to the UN, the result has been rising malnutrition and looming famine. The U.S. and Israel are reportedly moving forward with the creation of a new aid distribution initiative for Gaza. The United Nations said yesterday it would not take part in the plan, which would see private security contractors take over aid distribution operations in Gaza from the U.N. Speaking to reporters, Deputy U.N. spokesperson Farhan Haq said, quote, "This particular distribution plan does not accord with our basic principles, including those of impartiality, neutrality, independence, and we will not be participating in this." Close quote. In other news, the first round of peace talks involving Russia and Ukrainian officials ended inconclusively today. Besides agreeing to a 1,000-person prisoner exchange, the two teams found very little common ground, with the Ukrainian delegation saying that Russian demands were, quote, detached from reality, close quote. Pressure continues to have Putin and Zelensky meet directly, with President Trump also seeking a direct meeting with Putin. The Ukrainian government is seeking a 30-day total ceasefire similar to the one that ended World War II. Skepticism continues to surround the peace talks as Putin's motives remain clouded. Even President Trump, who made Ukraine a key campaign promise, stated, quote, "I think we'll solve it, but maybe not," close quote. And House Republicans couldn't nail down the votes needed to advance the GOP's giant budget reconciliation bill out of the Budget Committee today in the face of opposition from a handful of hardline Freedom Caucus members. The 21-16 vote, with five Republicans joining all panel Democrats in opposition, is not the final word on the mega bill. House GOP leaders plan to continue private talks with the reluctant Republicans and the White House over the weekend in hopes of resurrecting the package next week. Conservatives said the package does not go far enough to slash federal spending. To placate hard right members on the panel, GOP leaders are entertaining changes to the bill.